Welcome to Claim Your Confidence, a podcast that will introduce you to the most powerful people in the world. No matter what obstacles you face, Claim Your Confidence will inspire and motivate you to go after the life you want. Are you ready to claim your confidence?
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Claim Your Confidence. I'm Lydia Finette, coming to you out of New Sand Studios in Rockefeller Center. And joining me from Bethesda, Maryland, is the incredible Disha Dyer. Disha, thank you so much for coming on Claim Your Confidence.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I first heard your name from my friend Megan Salt. She had met you. She was completely obsessed with you. And so I started digging into your story and I could not get enough. And If I really think about the overarching theme of everything I read about you, Disha, it's about taking advantage of every single opportunity that presents itself to you. So let's start at the beginning. Where are you from originally?
I am originally from Philadelphia, so born and raised in Philadelphia, my home that I love so very much. So yeah.
I love it. Do you go back to Philadelphia a lot?
All the time. I go back to Philly constantly. Thankfully, I'm not that far. My family is still there, so I go back a lot to visit them. And then the summer is just magical there. So spend a lot of time in the summer in Philadelphia.
Did you grow up with a big family, small family?
Interestingly enough, my family's not that big, but I also, I went to boarding school in Hershey, Pennsylvania. So I would split my time between Philadelphia and Hershey. And in Hershey, Pennsylvania, I lived with 16 girls for 8 years. And so I like to say that I have a big family because I lived with 16 girls, but my actually blood family is not that large.
So I need to dig into boarding school. I went to boarding school as well. What age did you go?
So I went to boarding school when I was 9 years old. And it was a little different from other boarding schools. It was a boarding school for children from financially disadvantaged backgrounds. So whenever I say boarding school, people are like, oh my gosh. And I'm like, oh, wait, hold on. Like, let me explain about this school. But Milton and Catherine Hershey, who are obviously the chocolatiers of Hershey's chocolate, they can have children. And so they opened up an orphanage for boys, actually. And then it turned into, you know, it morphed over time and evolved and then, you know, accepting girls, or accepting people of color. And then I went in 1987. So, yeah.
What was that experience like? Because you were living at home, presumably, before that. Mm-hmm. And then did you apply? Did you go see it? I've never heard of this, but this is such an incredible thing. It reminds me of Little Women. I used to love it so much when I was little, about Joe, how opened an orphanage afterwards, but in a different way.
100%. My cousin went there. And so we were familiar with the school. We would visit him there. And then you do apply to get in. I think a lot of it has to do with like just income and background on your parents' part. And then once you get in, you kind of go for your orientation and see the school. And then you are put in a student home, is what they call it, a ranch home on a farm-like environment. And you live with 16 girls. And so the girls and the boys were separated. I graduated from there in 1995. And they supply everything for you, from like clothes if you need it, like toothpaste, feminine products. So all of that. And then you live in a home with two adults who are like your house parents. And then I would go home on the weekends sometimes and the holidays, and my parents would come see me also. So that was kind of Milton Hershey School in a nutshell.
Did you like it?
You know, I think like anybody, when you're there, you're like, this sucks. This is horrible. I want to go home. I want to wear like, you know, sneakers and jeans and all these things. And so I'd say that when I was there, I definitely had issues with it. I was always had authority issues anyway, but I always had issues with it because I was always getting in trouble. I'd say that when I left, I think I missed, you know, the community, the built-in community that we had there. I missed kind of the protected bubble that we were in some ways. Once I left Hershey, I was like, oh, wait, like this world is hard and, you know, tampons and pads are expensive. You know, like I didn't know about any of that stuff, you know, so I think I missed it once I left, but it was an experience.
Yeah. I like to say to people when they ask me about boarding school that one of the things that there is no doubt in my mind that came from boarding school was the structure and the discipline of the way that I live my life, because every hour is accounted for. You know,
every
they know
single one.
To keep you from getting out of trouble, probably. But like, it's literally like you are moving so quickly through that day, you barely have time to think about anything. And then you're in bed after study hall and period, end of sentence, days out, lights out, good
100%.
Night. And it's so funny to this day, I'm so regimented about certain things. Mm-hmm. And if I peel it back, it comes back to living with a really strict schedule of time. Did you go away to college after that?
I did. I went away to college to Cincinnati, Ohio, because at this point, my mom was living in Cincinnati. She had moved from Philadelphia. And so I went away to college and I was like, I'm on my own. Like, I think I went the other route of just like enjoying, like, you know, just not having to make my bed and do all these things.
Undoing all the discipline that you learned.
Yeah, I also went to college when I was 17. So I was like,
yeah.
I don't know who thought this was like a smart idea to put me in college at 17. My first attempt in college, I only lasted 2 semesters and then ended up leaving. But I did stay in Cincinnati then for a while after that.
And so then did you go back to college or did you start out on the next job? What was the next part of your career?
The next part of my career, I was 18 and I just got a job working at the mall. I mean, I just didn't know, you know, that's my first, you know, time really getting a job all day. And that's all I had to do. I didn't have to study or anything. So I got a job, like probably 3 jobs working at the mall. I remember working at the Potato King where we serve like potatoes with toppings in the food court. And then I'd go up one level and work at Things Remembered, the engraving shop. And then I'd go like to the connecting hotel, which was the Omni, and like do a third shift. Then I also did a lot of community work. So I was very involved with HIV AIDS since I was 14, 15 years old. So I got more involved in that in the city of Cincinnati. So that kind of filled my days and going out once in a while, dancing all night. But yeah.
It is so funny how people's paths take them in the most interesting routes and you don't know what's going to end up or how a journey is going to start. And yours, obviously, you'd already had a good 30 years of life and an incredible life, it sounds like, at this point.
Yeah.
But then there was one part of your life that was completely different. You applied for an internship at the White House.
Yeah, I was a little nuts. At this point, I had been a hip hop journalist. I wrote about hip hop for a number of years. I'd been an activist in the community. I was actually working at a real estate company and the mall at this point. And I tried to go back to college a couple times after I initially dropped out and no college would accept me. And so when I finally got accepted to a college, it was the Community College of Philadelphia. And I went there being like, this is ridiculous. I am 30 years old. Like, I need to go to a 4-year college. Like, I want to get my 4-year degree in social work. But since I couldn't get in anywhere, community college was kind of really the only place that accepted me. So when I went there, I was very focused. I think it's different going back to college when it's your own money and your own time. And it's just a different experience. I was very focused. And then in my first year there was when the presidential election kind of 2008 really started taking shape as far as just like us seeing Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama on TV. And I was very mesmerized because I was like, there's a woman, first of all, and then there's a Black person. And I was like, and one of them is going to be a nominee, which is just blew my mind. I mean,
like
just blew my mind as an American. And I was very excited about it because I had never seen that before. And obviously both of them represented groups I identify with, right? So I started following Barack Obama's just like speeches and his like, just like everything he would say and his campaign. And I was like, I want to work for him, but I don't know how you do that. I actually got an application for a White House internship from an AOL, I'm dating myself here, AOL listserv for community leaders. And it actually said, can you pass this along to youth, especially Black youth that would like to work at the White House? And I was like, well, what is it? And you're like a White House internship. And I was like, oh, well, what's this? And so I started looking into it because I was in community college. I knew how to write essays. I was qualified as a student. And so I filled it out just to see if I could do it. I didn't think I'd get chosen, but I filled it out and said, if I get it, cool. If not, no harm. So that's kind of how it all happened.
What were the questions? Or was it just like this is my name, this is where I live?
Lydia, you're going to laugh because you would think that these questions would be so intense. And so like definitely your name, you know, school, all that typical things, right? But then also it was like your favorite song, your favorite sports team, And I was just like, my favorite song and sports team. I was like, I guess they're looking for like personality, you know.
What did you say? What's your favorite song?
My favorite song is a singer from Oakland called Guapale is her name. And she had a song called Closer out. It's like very neo soul, like underground. It kind of made mainstream, but not a lot of people know it. Yeah. And so that was like my favorite song. It actually still is my ringtone to this day.
Wow.
And the Philadelphia Phillies had won the World Series that year, actually. And so I put the Philadelphia Phillies as my favorite team.
When you started working there, did you ever ask the internship coordinator, like, what are you looking for? What's the secret? Like, this is so interesting.
I think that the sports and the song was like, let's see the personality of this person. Like, let's see, like, you know, really the song is like, what vibe are they into? Is it like heavy metal? Is it hip hop? Like, let's see what vibe that is. Just like, that's like entertaining on an application. But I think for me, when I got chosen after the interview is because I got put in the department that responded to Americans' letters, like their request for the president's time. Somebody said, oh, can the president come to my kid's bar mitzvah? Mm-hmm. I would be the one on the other end as an intern writing back and being like, I'm very sorry. Like he's unable to make it. Or as an intern, we'd elevate it if we're like, this seems like it's a really important request. So I knew how to write. And so the department was all about writing. And so that's how I got chosen because I was a good writer.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. What did you do when you found out that you got the internship?
I did not see the first email that I got. It was more of a, you know, from the White House, but it looked like a form letter as a rejection. So I actually deleted it. And I was just like, I know I wasn't chosen. Like, I'm not going to read this email. I'm going to feel bad about myself. And then a few weeks later, before the internship happened, I received a phone call from the FBI and they were looking for my security clearance for the internship. The security clearance paperwork was in that email that I deleted. Had I not had this amazing person on the other end that was like, we should call this intern and be like, we haven't gotten your paperwork, I would have been done. That's exactly how it happened. And I think I screamed. I cried. I was like, oh my gosh, what do I do next? Where am I going to live? You know? So I started kind of putting those pieces together and before the next 3 weeks moving down to D.C.,
I love that the next call came from the FBI. Like, really, they're just elevating you immediately. Like, this is John from the FBI. And you're like, what have I done now?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what have I done? What has my family done? I was like, and I think that it was probably like, most likely this person was probably an intern for the FBI. Because I'm like, they clearly didn't put like a real Asian on this. You know what I mean? So I was like, they probably, you know, were just like, here, your assignment for the day is to call all these outstanding like slackers on their paperwork, you know? And I think that, you know, because it sounded like a grown person, but I'm like, they got the short end of the stick today, you know, calling potential interns.
Tracking down the delinquent interns.
Yeah, right? A 31-year-old wanted that. Like, who should know better? You know? I mean, it was just
nuts. Such a great story. Gosh. Yeah. So you've obviously found housing because you ended up as an intern. So
I did.
First day at the White House, Barack Obama is now the president.
Mm-hmm.
And you walk in the doors. Where do you go in the White House? What do you do in the internship program at the White House? Or what were you doing specifically?
I rented a room for $400 a month. Out of these people, they were getting a divorce and they were raising money for the divorce and they had an extra room. And so that's where I lived.
Was there therapy involved in that as well?
I mean, I was like, I'm just going to stay in my room with my DVD player and my TV. I was like, I just need to shower and eat here. So the first day, a bunch of interns, we had connected online and we met at a coffee shop right near the White House. And you are escorted into the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. And then you go into a big auditorium and you're like sizing people up, like, you know, like, where are you from? Like, where? And I clearly was like older, you know, I'm like, hey, 19-year-old, like, hey, 20-year-old, you know, and they gave us our orientation, told us what we'd be doing. I was in the Office of Scheduling and Advance. And so I basically supported the staff on the president's schedule, all of his travel, responded to everyday Americans, made phone calls on behalf of the president to like, be like, oh, he can't make this, whatever it is. You know, I think the first couple of days, I couldn't believe that that was my life. I was like, I can't believe I'm here. Like, it was definitely a jolt of, you know, like imposter syndrome / confidence issues of being like, everyone here is like 19, 20. They probably really go to four-year schools, and or their parents knew somebody. They all were wearing navy or black. You know, it's just like navy suits or black suits. And I'm just with my Ross Dress for Less outfit. Like, you know, I had no idea. You know, I wore like black khakis because I had no idea what you're supposed to wear. But my work was good. You know, I knew what I was doing. And I think that's what kind of got me elevated to the point where I got hired.
How quickly did that happen? You were an intern for how long? Because I know the promotions came relatively quickly, right?
They did, yeah. I was an intern for 3 months. So I was an intern from September to December of 2009, which is usually the average term for the internships. And then I left. And when I left, I went right back to my same life in Philly. I was working, but I stayed in touch with the White House. And I did a trip for President Obama where he was going to Missouri. And that was in March. And then they called me about a full-time job in May of 2010.
And what was that job?
I was the coordinator for all the interns in the department. So it was the person who called me. It was now my job to pick the interns for the department and be in charge of them. And the person that was my boss when I was there as an intern was going on to work somewhere else. And so they were like, Deisha, we asked everybody. And everyone's like, you got to bring Deisha back. You got to bring Deisha back. I took the job like as soon as it was offered. I didn't even ask how much it was paid. I didn't ask anything. I was like, yes, I'll take it. And I started full-time in June of 2010 at the White House.
That's amazing. What a great story to get there.
Thank you, Lydia. I was very happy with just that. I was like, this is great. Like, I'll stay at this $42,000 job for the rest of the term. I was just happy to be there. So when the promotion started, it wasn't a surprise. It was just like unexpected. I didn't think I could be promoted. I thought my lucky break was getting the internship and then getting hired, not then, you know, moving up the ranks to this senior position. So, yeah.
I feel like we've been on this podcast for 20 minutes at this point, and I can already see why somebody would hire you. I mean, you have such a lovely demeanor, first and foremost, but also there's just something about you that's equally commanding and fun. And I can imagine everybody would just want to have you around all the time. I can see it. So I understand, as someone who used to hire a lot of people, why you would be hired immediately. But I would love to know, for those of us who sit outside of the White House, what is it like to go to the White House? I mean, I know it's a building. I know it's an office building. I'm old enough to understand that that's what it is, but it's the White House. Like, what does that feel like?
It feels like exclusive and insider. You know, you have like inside secrets and you know different stuff, and you just walk in, and once you walk into the complex, because I worked in the EEOB, the adjacent building, but it's still in the same complex for the first 4 years that I was there. So I went in the White House for like events here and there, maybe some meetings, but I actually did not go in the executive mansion that much until I moved over to the first lady's office for my second promotion. And that was when I was like, my office was in the actual executive mansion. And I think that like something about the White House is like, it's a museum, it's somebody's home, and it's an office. So it's all these three things in one. And I think that I never grew tired of like walking through there, because I just couldn't believe that I had a pass that allowed me to just like walk on the complex, go in the gates, and then just like walk in the halls. Like, you know, like I just could do that whenever I wanted to do that. And I was like, this is not normal, you know? It's a special place, I think. And I think what made it so special was also, you know, just the staff that worked there, the butlers and the ushers and the housekeeping. They're all the same. So they've been the same every administration. And you just learn so much. And that becomes like a little family, you know. But it was a lot. I can't say, Lydia, that I've even so processed all that. You know, I can't.
Yeah.
I think still 7 years later, 7 years from walking out of there, I still haven't processed all that it was. It was just such a special time in my life and in the country. Really, as well. So,
you talked a little bit about imposter syndrome when you were saying, you know, you kind of felt like when you walked in there, you didn't belong, or you're just like, I can't believe I have a pass. What did you do to get through that from the beginning? Did you fake it? Did you did you slowly, as the promotions came, feel your confidence coming faster? Did it sort of change over time? Did you always feel like that? Or every time when they promoted you, were you like, what, me? Or was there a point where you were like, no, I'm here. I'm good at what I'm doing. I deserve this. And I'm going to do a great job for you. And I know it. Did it ever get to that point?
Unfortunately, it didn't. It never got there. I think that I always felt like it was pure luck almost. And I always was very scathed by, like, I don't have a full education. And mind you, when I went to the White House, I continued going to school. So I graduated from community college right when we were reelecting the president. So I was going to school the entire time I worked at the White House the first couple of years. It never got to that point because I never had a chance to catch my breath to be like, I deserve to be here. It was always like, okay, what's next? Okay, what's next? And I spent so much time and energy trying to prove that I was supposed to be there that I don't think I realized for myself that I was supposed to be there. And I think that my imposter syndrome was really root deep. Like, it was very rooted from being a child. And so I think that you can't just get rid of that with one accomplishment. I think that for me, I had to dig up the root of where it came from so it didn't replant itself and, like, continue to show itself with every promotion, with every accomplishment. And unfortunately, I didn't do that at the White House. It came after. But I think that what got me through really is because I actually really love what I did. Like, I love my jobs, all of them that I had there. I love interacting with the public. I love traveling around the world. And I love being able to, like, help Mrs. Obama open up the White House. And so those were things that were, like, second nature to me. You know, I loved it. So I was like, I got this platform. I got this privilege. Like, let's go. Like, what are we doing? So I think that that made it so I got through based off of the jobs that I had and knowing how to do them well. I can't ever say that I sat, you know, fully in confidence and was like, I, you know, like, I deserve to be here. It's more like, you know what, like, you all, you know, deserve to have somebody like me here that can open up the doors for you. But it was never, so I never am like really fully stepped into my confidence until probably after I was done.
It's an incredible thing, imposter syndrome and just confidence in general, because so many times, if you really think about it, I mean, who there knew that you went to community college if you didn't tell them? You know what I mean? Like all of these things that we pile on ourselves, it's such an interesting thing in life because so much of what we do to ourselves and our confidence comes from the inside, right? Yeah. I can't tell you how many times I've spoken to someone and they're telling me about this moment and I'm thinking to myself, like, nobody even knew. Like no one except for you knew that. And you were out there doing this job that clearly you were doing well. Otherwise, you don't get promoted, I suspect, in the White House unless you know what you're doing. It doesn't seem like a place where they're like really excited about a lot of errors, public errors, especially when it deals with the public. Clearly, you were proving yourself day after day and the only person you're fighting that battle against is yourself. You know, and I do think as women, this is something you see across the board, but I mean, you're really at the highest level dealing with this as well, which is so interesting.
Yeah.
You said you had four jobs, and I know one of them was the internship coordinator. Let's talk about the cool jobs. So the social secretary, the deputy, like, tell me, okay, so the first promotion from internship coordinator is what?
The first promotion was the director of hotel logistics. When I was younger, I used to watch The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous, and Robin Leach, I used to just dream that I could, like, get paid to travel like that. I was like, this man does nothing but travel and then report from these locations. And I bet he's staying at these four-star hotels and he's like getting all this stuff. And I was like, how do people do that? And then I would see people and hear about people traveling for business. And I was like, your company pays for you to go to LA and they pay. And it was such a mind-boggling thing to me, but I've always wanted to, I always love hospitality. I love hotels. I'm still obsessed with hotels. So when I found that there was a job at the White House in the department that I was at that actually was in charge of the hotels, I was like, what do you do? They're like, oh, you help pick the hotels. And then when the president or first lady travels, you go with them. And I'm like, well, clearly they're not staying at these cheap hotels. Like, oh my gosh.
No.
So when that woman left, I was like, hello, pick me. I'm ready to travel. Like, what's up with this? So that was the second job after the coordinator, the interns. And then I think that job just ran its course as far as just like we after the reelection, staff was changing. And then there was an opportunity to move to the first lady's office to be the deputy social secretary. And I had always wanted to work with Michelle Obama. I mean, because Michelle Obama. And when I was intern, I put it as number one of my offices when I ranked it. And I didn't get it, obviously. And so I was like, Michelle Obama. And so I moved over to be the deputy social secretary, assisting the social secretary, Jeremy Bernard, with all the events and managing staff. And it was great. I learned so much. And then me and Jeremy went out to eat one night. And I was like, well, I want to tell him I'm leaving after 2 years because I'm never going to move up. He's never leaving. And then he told me he was leaving. And I was like, oh, okay, well, so am I. And then he's like, no, you're not. He's like, well, I don't think you should leave yet. I think you should try for the social secretary. And I was like, are you out of your mind? Like, you are very much out of your mind. And it wasn't even like a joking out of your mind. It was like, have you had too much to drink? Like, what's wrong with you? I would never get this job. And then he encouraged me, and then other people encouraged me. And then, yeah, then I was announced as a social secretary April of 2015. So, yeah.
What a story.
What is nuts.
It's incredible. But again, you know, I truly believe if you show up and you do the job and you do it with passion, people notice. That is a true thing. And, you know, experience gets you so far. I talk about this a lot with my friends these days. It's like, it's great that you have the resume where you can check off the boxes. But if you 100%. Don't show up with enthusiasm or passion, it's not the same. Someone who comes in there is willing to work, do the work. You will never find anyone who you want to have as much as an employee, because you can't train that into someone.
You can't. And the authenticity that comes with that, it's just like, no, I didn't know all the diplomacy. I didn't know all the decorum. Like, you know, I walked in with my hoop earrings. Like, I didn't conform to, I had like, you know, my nose ring. I didn't change all of that. And the Obamas didn't mind that. And they were asking me to work hard and do my job. And, you know, there were definitely mistakes and along the way, like no one's perfect, but you know, I feel like we did a really great job. People still remember, like, I remember this party that you did and this event that you did. And when you brought this, and I'm like, you know, like that's what's important to me, is that people remember that, like, I was a social secretary that was like, no, like we don't have to follow every protocol. Like, let's do something different, you know, and let's open this up a little bit or try something different. And I was very blessed that I had the Obamas the last couple of years where they were like, sure. Okay.
Do it. Blow it out.
Let's do it. And I was like, great. You know, like, you don't mind a marching band on the lawn? Great. I got a full marching band. Come on, guys. You know what I mean? Like, it was, you know.
You're like, I hope you said you didn't mind, because they're already out there.
They're already out happening. There, you know, they're already out there. Mrs. Obama was so funny, because she'd be like, Tisha, I don't know how this is going to go. I'm like, yeah, me neither, but, you know. And then as she was getting ready, it was the opening of the National Museum of the African American History and Culture. As she was getting ready for the event, she like came out on the balcony and was like dancing to the band practicing. And I was like,
This is so good.
All I need it. All I need it.
It's funny. My first 10 years in the company I worked at before Christie's, I ran events. I was in the events department, and I ran the events department. And one thing I will never forget, someone saying to me once, I must have looked really worried about something, because I became the head of the department when I was 26. Like, it was such a quick series of promotions. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, wait. I'm in charge of this. Like, are you sure? Like, I'm supposed to be running this? Okay, I can do this. And I remember I must have looked a little worried at this particular dinner, because things were really not going the way I thought they were going to. And he walked by me and he's like, remember that nobody knows. If your face shows it, everyone knows it.
Mm.
I've never forgotten that. And I do it on stage as an auctioneer too, because when things are going wrong, like, everything can be going wrong and I'm in charge. So if I look like everything's going wrong, then everyone assumes something's going wrong. And so I swear to God, from that moment on, I had a smile plastered on my face. I mean, there could have been sprinklers, like raining water down. I'm like, part of the art installation. I know, we're so happy this is going on. And it is so true. Like, the leader leads by example. And if show up and you're just like, you're Michelle Obama, and even if that marching band was off key and everything was awful and she was dancing on the balcony, everyone's like, best party I've ever been to.
I love that advice, Lydia. Yeah, honestly, I think that is such good advice, because I think that oftentimes, especially if you have confidence issues or you suffer from imposter syndrome, things like that, I think that the first thing you do is turn it around on yourself. Like, what did I do wrong? And then your demeanor changes, like everything, like your vibe changes. And I think that, you know, that's such great advice. I've not heard that, but I'm going to follow that advice too. I think that's great. That's great. When we had Pope Francis come, and I remember being like, you know what, like 12, like all these people on this lawn, like, you know, there's been a streaker before in other administrations when popes have come, like, so is somebody going to pass out? Like, I was just smiling, like God, like, if there's any day that you're going to make this day perfect, it is when we have Pope Francis. I need you to come through.
Please let this be the day. I need you to come through.
All these years of prayers. Of people. Like, you know what I mean? I was just like, and everyone's like, it's going to be fine. I'm like, tell God that, like, it has to be fine. like, because the world was, the eyes were so on us. Like, yeah. It's the Pope's first visit to the White House. Like, it was like, the first visit to the country. And I'm just like, and I'm the one in charge of this. I was like, let me go to church.
Yeah, exactly. I need to get on my hands and knees. I need to get the church tree, the phone tree going. All my everyone I know needs to be praying about
this. Whatever I need to do.
I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that a lot of this is out in your book, which I am going to buy the minute that this is over, because I cannot wait to hear and read more about these stories. Your book, Undiplomatic, that comes out April 25th.
Yes.
As an author, I had another author named Ellen Hildebrand on a couple of episodes ago, and she was talking about the confidence that it takes to be an author, because it takes a lot to put it all out there, as you know. So tell me how you're feeling. First book, it's exciting.
Yeah, I think that honestly, especially writing a book about confidence, and I don't know if you experienced too with your book, but it's just like, it's funny and it's not to be like, I'm writing a book about confidence. And I'm not quite sure if I should be writing a book about, you know what I mean? Like, you're just like, okay, Deesha, like, buckle up. This is a time that I was like, buckle up, because when you asked me about when you got that confidence, I will say that it was definitely writing this book. And I say that because I know that I have a story to tell. Like, I've seen the testimony when I go out and speak. And every time I go out and speak, people are like, so when's the book coming? That's always a question. And I'm always like, you know? And so I think that the confidence it takes to just put your art out there, whether you're writing fiction, nonfiction, or whatever it is, to be vulnerable, is something that I have never experienced, because I'm writing about my past life as my present life. And so you've got to also not get down on yourself for any mistakes you could have made, or like, you know, everything's in hindsight. And so I think that that was probably my biggest challenge, is being like, I'm writing this book about a past life, but I have to be honest with readers and be like, no, I wasn't always confident. No, this promotion did not do that. And in my introduction, I'm very clear when I say, yes, I got to a place where I have a different relationship with imposter syndrome now, where I feel like it's used against us in ways to keep us where we are, like especially women, Black people, whoever, where like we think it's our fault and it's our responsibility we feel this way. But there are also systems in place that continue to make us feel this way. But I'm very clear in the intro where I say, like, it's not helpful for me to write this book from a healed place in which I am, because that's not where a lot of you are. And so that was a going back in time to like be like, oh, if I would have said that. Oh, I should have done that. Like, that was the hardest thing for me writing this book, I'd say.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. In my first book, I wrote pre-COVID. It's called The Most Powerful Woman in the Room is You. Mm. And it's very much like a girl boss. It's where I was in my career. I was like, I just had my third kid, firing on all cylinders. Like, I've always been, as my friends would say, like an annoyingly optimistic person. Like, I can find joy in anything. And that's really the way I truly am. And you know, I read that book now and I think to myself, like, there were so many things going on at that point in my life that I would never have shared in that book, because it just seemed too raw, right?
Yes.
And then when I wrote Claim Your Confidence, I started it by talking about my book signing with one person, because I wanted it to be more raw. And it's amazing, because you get so much feedback from being truly honest with people, because everybody thinks it's fun to be great and successful. But at the end of the day, success is not all day, every day. And what makes us successful is learning through the failures. And so 100%. All those bad things that happen are just what set us up and push us into that zone of confidence, which we're all looking for. So I love that you wrote that book, and I can't wait to dive in.
Thank you so much. I'm really excited for people to read it, because I think what your message about being raw and authentic, I've always been that way, probably like too much that way sometimes. But I think part of it is also like, you know, when people see me, like, you know, they like see me in Vogue or some other magazine or something, they have a certain perception, like about me, or about like being the social secretary or how things work. And then they meet me and they're like, oh my gosh, like, you're so down to earth. You're so cool. And so I'm like, what good does it do me to highlight all these amazing, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff in the book about the White House, but like, what good does it do for like me to write all about all this stuff that doesn't seem attainable for people? So let me start at a human level of like, yo, this is who I am. So you could see that like, we are not, there is not much of a difference. Like, there isn't, you know, even though I was at the White House, I had this really you know, fancy job. Like, this is not how it started. So, like, yeah. I need you to hear about the beginning.
There was an engraving station at the mall.
Yeah, yes, exactly. I want you to hear about the beginning of, like, overdrafting checking accounts. Like,
totally.
You know, like, scramming up, like, $1.05 to buy, like, a five-piece nugget at Wendy's with barbecue sauce. Like, like, it wasn't always this way. You know what I mean? And even when I went to the White House, those things were hard for me to adjust to. That I mean, not like I had money, but like I had a steady job that I was like, oh, okay, like this is good. But I still had to, like, you know, pay debt and all these other things. And so I like to be real, because then it hooks people also to be like, oh, now I can read the rest of the book because now I see myself in her. If I would have started with, like, you know, yeah, the White House, this happened with the Pope and like this celebrity, they've been like, okay, here she goes, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like, and not faulting people who do that. That's just not my style, you know?
Yeah, so, absolutely. Well, we were talking about Megan Salt, who was the one who introduced us at the beginning of this. And I've known Megan since my early 20s when I was living in New York. And when she was working for a PR company, she used to have access. And you probably have seen this if you've ever seen, like, The Devil Wears Prada or any of those movies. Like, the women who were my age who worked at PR companies at that time had access to samples. And at that point, you didn't have social media, so they weren't getting them in front of celebrities. They would just send it to anyone who was kind of going out. Mm-hmm. Because I was an auctioneer and I was on stage, I could call them and they'd lend me the samples, which never really fit and were very uncomfortable, but I thought I needed to be wearing.
Right.
Anyway, I had this amazing story that one night I went to a dinner where I was wearing this absolutely beautiful dress that I had borrowed for this dinner. And I remember at the end of dinner, they gave everyone like a piece of jewelry for coming to the dinner. And I would gone, I think because my boss couldn't go. I can't remember, but it wasn't like, I wasn't really supposed to be there. But it was, I mean, it was like this beautiful piece of jewelry and everyone got it. And it was very what, like, influencer of today, but this is like early 2000. Mm. And we were at this place called Budokan, had this long staircase. And I walked up.
I remember Budokan.
Yep. Yeah, it's still around. But I walked up the long staircase and I go out into New York City streets, and Uber and Lyft didn't exist at all in New York City. And taxicabs didn't take credit cards. And I remember I used to get my paycheck and it would go into my account Wednesday night at midnight. So I knew, like, that's how I was living in my early 20s in New York City. I was making no money working at Christie's. And I remember going out and being like, oh my God, I'm wearing like 7-inch heels. I have on this like thousands of dollars of dress on. I don't even have enough cash to get home. And I went to the ATM to get out money. And it was like 11 o'clock at night. I didn't have $20 to get out of the ATM. And so I had to sit in the vestibule because it was too far to walk. I had to sit in the vestibule until midnight to wait for my money to come in so I could withdraw
Lydia,
the money.
No.
And then the best part is, as I left, there was a homeless man waiting. And he was like, I need money. Like, I can't. No. Like, I am not allowed to give away money. I've got to go home. It was the most, like, to this day, I remember, I almost wrote that in one of my books, but I didn't have a chapter to wrap it around. But
I sat there until midnight.
I sat there.
You had
until
no choice.
Midnight. What was I going to do? I couldn't walk barefoot through the streets of New York, and I couldn't walk like 70 blocks in a pair of heels. I wasn't going on the subway in that dress. I mean, it was really, I think about moments like that, which you talk about build character. It's so fun to think back on moments like that because you
is.
Do have in these unbelievable careers, those moments of like high, low that you're like, God, if people could see this side of it.
Right? And the book is full of those stories and like, even sometimes when I'm in the stories, like right after the White House, I had a meeting at Vogue. I never forget this. I was trying to figure out my life. And I was like, should I go work in New York? I didn't know what to do. And I remember that the train was so late. I got fully ready for this meeting at Vogue in the Penn Station bathroom. And I will never forget being like, oh my gosh, when I walked in Condé Nast, I was like, I hope I don't smell like that bathroom. Because I had no perfume or anything. And it's in the book because I just like want people to know that, like, you do what you got to do in the moment. You know what I mean? Like, where am I going to get ready? Like, I couldn't get ready on New Jersey Transit. Like, so like, I went, and that's before they remodeled the station. You know what I mean? But those moments, I think, really, I think, keep us grounded in some ways. Yeah. Like, that people relate to us. It's just like, it's not a... Like, I'm fully transparent, but I'm also transparent about, like, these also embrace the really dope and amazing things I've done. You know what I mean? Yeah. I don't downplay them. I'm like, yeah, no, that was me. No, yeah, I did that. Then that came over time that I was able to embrace that, you know, that confidence of what I've done. Yeah.
Well, Disha, thank you so much for coming on today. What a pleasure this has been. Undiplomatic comes out April 23rd, so buy it today. I'm going to buy it the minute I hang up this podcast. I can't thank you enough. Disha, tell us where we can follow along. Obviously, the book's coming out. What else can we do to support you? Let me know when you're in New York. I will come to your book signing. Yes. I show up for these things. I promise.
So DishaDyer.com. So just my first and last name. Basically, we'll have all information about the book. We're about to put up some dates on there for tour dates, but it also has things about my business and speaking and anything else that I do, my nonprofit. And I always like to hear from people on Instagram or it was just all on my website, or people just say hi, my website. So yeah, that's where you can find me.
I love it. Well, I always leave my listeners with a thought or a question. So I would say to everyone, in the spirit of Disha, what opportunity are you going to take advantage of? When are you going to raise your hand for that next promotion? Do something big. DM us both about that, because I know we would both love to hear it. Again, Disha, thank you so much for coming on the show. I want to thank Joe for being such an amazing producer and helping us with all the tech as always.
Yes.
Thank you to Rockefeller Center, Newsstand Studios. It's always such a pleasure to be in here. And Disha, I hope when you're in New York for your book signing, which will be sold out, I hope you'll stop by and see us. Thanks again, everyone, for joining. This is Claim Your Confidence. I will be with you next Tuesday.